My castaway this week is a writer and comedian. To television audiences, he's familiar as the Man from Auntie, a stand-up comic who is loud, fast and iconoclastic. But behind the quick-fire delivery and naughty gags lurks a more thoughtful personality, a successful novelist, playwright and television scriptwriter with shows like The Young Ones, Blackadder and The Thin Blue Line to his credit. All his books have sold well, but his latest, Popcorn, has been highly acclaimed by the critics. Still not yet 40, he feels he may be mellowing a little, able to respond at last to the advice of a lecturer at university who told him he could be a good writer if he could dispense with his, quote, ruthless pursuit of the one-line gag. He is Ben Elton. Do you now reluctantly admit, Ben, that that lecturer had a point?
Not reluctantly at all, Sue. I remember the advice well because at the time I rather bristled. I thought it was the voice of somebody who didn't like comedy and wanted everything to be terribly serious. I was at university at Manchester and I thought he was denying the potency of light entertainment. My heroes were always more Eric and Ernie than Vladimir and Estragon, and I felt rather kind of pugilistic about standing up for LE, as it was known then. But I now know that actually the best LE is as carefully honed and edited as any major play.
But the ruthless pursuit of the one-line gag is exactly what your stand-up act, your writing, what your stand-up act is all about, isn't it? I mean, if you can pick up laughs along the way as you go on churning it out, that's what you do.
Well, yes, but I think my stand-up act actually is a good example of where I've actually taken that advice subconsciously, because I tend to try and weave ideas together, and although the jokes, hopefully, not so much jokes as sort of comic observations, surreal sort of little takes on that which we all recognise. You just take a lateral view and suddenly you've got a laugh. But I wouldn't call that ruthless. I'd call that sort of loving the idea along the way until you find some kind of strange communal conclusion with the audience.
But you go so fast, one wonders that you have any time to kind of assess or feel the feedback from that audience.
No, not at all. I do speak very quickly, but I think quite quickly, and that's really where I gain my thoughts. I tend to come to my conclusions by exploring them rather than by thinking about them privately.
So it isn't that you've pre-learned it and you go out and deliver the thing that's already in your head. You alter it
It's a combination of both. But yes, it is very definitely pre-learned. The act is pre-learned. I could publish it, and indeed bits of it have been published. But each night you have to recreate it. So I'm trying to communicate.
Do you enjoy it?
I enjoy it afterwards. I enjoy sitting back with a pint and beer and having done it. I don't get any kind of performance buzz in the way sort of, you know, rock singers like Mick Jagger might say, you know, it's the adrenaline, man, you've got to feel it every night, you know, and you need the buzz. It's not sort of making love and wandering home alone. It's far too much an effort to get my thoughts in order. It's an intellectual exercise. Sounds rather pompous, but I sort of enjoy it. But I love having made myself understood, because the laughter of the audience means they understand the point you're making.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, I've chosen a number from the Beatles album Revolver. I think, as indeed do many, that the Beatles are the greatest band of all time, and for me, Lennon and McCartney are the greatest composers of all time. It's pointless to make such silly comparisons and definitions, but this program makes you think, and, you know, life without the Beatles, I think, would be a very, very different thing. I love them. I love everything they did, but I've chosen And Your Bird Can Sing from Revolver.
With And Your Bird Can Sing from the album Revolver. So, Ben Elton, Noel Coward was the great hero, wasn't he, of your youth?
The word hero is something I don't feel that that attuned to. I was inspired by his life enormously.
I thought you wanted to be him.
I didn't want to be him. I wanted to have his life, to live in the theatre, to amuse, to entertain. I've always loved entertainment.
But to both write and to be on the stage, that's the point.
It was the writing that fascinated me, and just the idea of being so witty.
You were living, I think, in Guildford in Surrey at the time, and making frequent appearances at the Borough Hall in Godalming. Is that right?
Frequent appearances? You flatter me, Sue. I was, during my late non-teens and early teens, and middle teens indeed, I was a huge Am-dram man. I just loved theatre.
But what did you play?
Well, my finest hour, I think, was indeed at Godalming Borough Hall for 13 nights, which is quite a run for an Am-dram sock, was The Artful Dodger in Oliver, for which the Surrey Advertiser were very kind. They said I showed promise for the future. About the last good notice I got for the following 20 years, actually.
And you did My Fair Lady as well.
I was up for anything. I was Lancelot Gobbo in A Merchant of Venice at Guildford Castle. I was in the Herald Players, the Curtain Raisers, the Godalming Theatre Group, and a number of others, and all the school shows I could be in.
You've been in Peter Pan?
Yes, the first show I did was the Curtain Raisers at Onslow Village Hall, and I played Slightly Soiled, which is one of the Lost Boys. Godalming Theatre Group was my main interest from about the age of 12 onwards, and I'm president of the Godalming Theatre Group now, something I'm extremely proud of, and I still have very firm connections with them.
But you don't very often appear at Godalming Borough Hall.
I don't appear, but I do appear in the audience.
But you were writing, you were churning out the stuff as well, weren't you?
Churning out.
Well, you were prolific, weren't you?
I became prolific. I started to write a little, having discovered through Noel Coward's life that one could write as well as perform. Very quickly, writing began to interest me far more than performance. And yes, I started to write. I was a huge Eric and Ernie fan then, as I am now, and I tried to write sketches for them, which were just, you know, you can't see the join and all the catchphrases.
So you were very keen, you were very enthusiastic, you were what you call farty.
Well, the term farty came about much later, and I've sort of tried to escape it a little, because it's so often misunderstood, and rightly so.
Well, go on, define it.
Let's face it, farty tends to suggest flatulence, and that's not really what I mean. I've always been an enthusiast. I love to be alive, if that sounds like a farty thing to say. I like to be involved in what's going on. I'm a bit of a, come on, gang, let's do the show. And when I was at university, there were sort of two types. There was the, come on, gang, let's do the show. And then there were the cool guys that said, oh, what's the point, man? It's all crap, you know.
And you disapprove of cynicism?
I disapprove instantly. I don't want to sound pompous. I find cynicism the most boring and the laziest pose. And what's irritating about it is that it appears to be clever. Because the easiest thing in the world to do is believe in nothing and to deride everything. Oh, they're all hypocrites. Nothing's worth doing. And if you stand up and say, well, actually, I respect that person, or actually, I think this is worth making the effort, you sort of look like a bit of a git.
Is farty being a git?
Sort of. I mean, in my stand-up routine, I've always celebrated smallness. I think it's funny how, particularly in American comedy, the cool is what's funny. The cooler you are, the funnier you are. In a way, the crueler you are. If you win, you're funny. I think one of the great things about British comedy is that we celebrate weakness, pomposity, sadness, vulnerability. Look at Fawlty, look at Captain Mannering, Rick and the Young Ones, or even the Blackadder. And in my stand-up act, I've always looked within. I've always looked at, you know, my own secret fears and worries. And it's wonderful to find how much they communicate, that we all are sort of a little scared, are scared of being liked or not being liked, scared of our whatever powers we may or may not have. And so to sort of celebrate the fact that we're not cool.
Record number two.
Well, I mean, talking about cool, Elvis is, to me, the king of rock and roll, and I believe this is one of the greatest vocals ever laid down, Heartbreak Hotel.
Well, since my baby left, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of the lonely street, that Heartbreak Hotel. I'll be so lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely. I'll be so lonely, I could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down the street to heartbreak hotel where you will be because so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely you could die.
Elvis Presley and Heartbreak Hotel.
The King.
Tell me a bit more about your family, Ben, because they're rather academically distinguished, aren't they?
Well, yes, I suppose you could certainly say that. Both my parents are in teaching. My mother was an English teacher, a school teacher, and my father was in academia. His family, particularly my father's family, are deeply academic. They were sort of professors and historians in the line.
You had an uncle who was the Regius Professor of Modern History at Cambridge, I think.
Yes, Geoffrey Elton, my dad's brother, was he's died now, but he was Sir Geoffrey, in fact. I think Thatch gave him that.
But all of that background leads people to believe that your accent is bogus. Somehow, if people hold positions like that, they can't have brought up a son who speaks with an estuary accent. Now, what's the truth? Is it bogus?
It's a source of great frustration to me, a little frustration, the snobbery around that. My voice does change. Everyone has telephone manners. I certainly speak a little bit better when I'm speaking to you, Sue, but then again, I think everyone does. But my accent is entirely real. I was, and why wouldn't it be? I was born in southeast London. My father's an immigrant. His English is his third language. He was born in Germany. Then they became Czech citizens when Hitler came to power in Germany, and then the family came to Britain. So actually, English is his third first language, so to speak. My mother's from Cheshire. And I was born in southeast London and went to state primary school, state junior school. And
so you ought to speak like John Major, really.
Well, it's funny. My mum did laugh that when this business about estuary English came up, this great idea, there's this new accent that's not Cockney, it's not Essex, it's estuary or whatever. This article suggested that John Major and I had similar accents, but that his was real and mine was affected. But the interesting thing is, we have almost identical backgrounds.
Anyway, what did the parents say when you were 16 and you announced that you wanted to leave school and sweep up backstage in some theatre or other?
Well, I was terribly fortunate. My parents are very thoughtful people, and we have a very close family. And I was saying, I want to leave school. There's no point. I don't want to go to university. University doesn't, you know, I don't know, Gielgud never went to university or whatever. They felt very strongly that I was being a bit naive and that it would be better to wait to make these decisions, better to sort of stay in education, at least till I knew who I was. And I was terribly lucky that there was an article one day about this marvellous course in Stratford-on-Avon at a college of further education, just a state college, but a marvellous A-level course run by an inspirational man called Gordon Valens, who had come up with the idea of a theatre studies A-level. Theatre as part of education, theatre as part of life, not just, you know, reading about Brecht and Gielgud, but theatre as life. And I passed the interview and got onto it. And so I left home at 16, and I actually, after a brief period in Diggs, I lived in a caravan in a field, you know, friends nearby. It was a marvellous, marvellous time.
Very trendy.
Yeah, well, I don't think I made the most of it. I never had a girlfriend in all the time I had.
Well, not in the caravan.
No, I wish I had. Looking back, God, if only. I had a little Honda 50, and I used to drive into a college in Stratford, and
You didn't have a girl in that either.
I had an unrequited love affair. I was in love with someone who didn't fancy me. We were friends.
Tell me about record number three.
I've chosen London Calling from the London Calling album by The Clash. I wasn't a punk myself, wasn't quite cool enough, but I did cut my hair and I did stop wearing flares about 78, you know. I think The Clash are a truly great rock and roll band. I think Strummer Jones, great, great songwriters, and this is a fantastic example of their work, London Calling.
Boys and girls, London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing, except for the rain and the crunch of beer. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is within.
things you stop on him. But I have no fear to plunder the crown and I live by the river to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, please keep going alone. London calling to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling and I don't want to shout. But while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see we ain't got no hide. Except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in. Engine stuck on it, the wheat is going big. A nuclear error, but I have no fear. Cause London is found and I live by the river.
Clash and London Calling. So university, Manchester, reading drama, and importantly there you met Rick Mayall and Ade Edmondson, with and for whom you were to write The Young Ones. Was it love at first sight?
Rick and I became friends instantly, yes, actually. I admired him enormously. It's funny, I saw him on stage. They did a sort of freshers review, the third years. Rick and Ade were third years when I was a first year, and they did a little review for the freshers, I think in an effort to pull the girls, frankly. Because I was a first year, there is that divide. Mm. He always had this great joke where he'd say, "Hi, fresher, I can't remember your name," even though he knew very well what my name was, and we'd been friends for a year. And that relationship actually coloured our early relationship writing together. I was always trying to please him, and I think some very good work emerged from that. And when Rick's opportunity came, Paul Jackson said, "Look, you guys look hot. Do you want to try and develop a pilot for a sitcom script?" He decided that, you know, that old mate might be a useful member of the team. So
and this
it was
the young one, that was the BBC one. And so, as a result, by the age of 21, technically anyway, you were a BBC scriptwriter.
Mm.
But then suddenly you decided to become a stand-up comic. Why? Where did that come from?
I was broke. The Young Ones was just beginning. I mean, we weren't paid for this script. But the BBC merely said, "We'll read it if you write it." So that was happening. It was January, February 81. I'd left university. My plays were not being picked up by the RSC scriptwriter or the Royal Court scriptwriter. Funnily enough, I was not earning a living, and my work was not being seen. So I was desperately thinking, how can I move forward in entertainment? And the only option I had was my own self.
Can you remember what your first routine was about?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of bits were good, but I mean, part of it, I did do an impression of Ronald Reagan, including a Grecian 2000 gag, for which I weep with shame to this day.
Go on, let's have it.
No. I can't. Well, I honestly, I don't. It wasn't an impression. It was an American accent and a few lefty jokes about, I suppose, probably ageist jokes by looking back on it. But the good bit of the act was I did an impression of a sexist, racist comedian. Now, in 1996, that might seem dreadfully tired old satire, indeed politically correct, and what's wrong with a few good gags, this and that. But at the time, comedy tended to be brutalisation, tended to be taking the mick out of minorities. People are much more reluctant to do that now. So when people sneer at political correctness or things, just let them remember the amount of ground that's been covered. For instance, one of the big things I was knocked for was not presuming on the sexuality of the audience. So I would sometimes say, you know, the straight women in the audience will know what I mean if I'm talking about having it off with a man or something, or the gays will know what I mean. Now, this was seen as outrageous piety by some journalists. It wasn't piety. It was a simple reaction that I'd had from, I remember at university seeing a badge which I thought was terribly clever. A woman was wearing it. How dare you presume I'm a heterosexual? Now, in 79, that was interesting. I mean, these days, I think it would be unnecessary. We've all moved on. It would actually look pious now and rather divisive. But then, before anyone had even thought, hey, hang on a minute, yes, she might well not be a heterosexual. You know, these were interesting thoughts that moved us all on. And they certainly affected me.
More music.
Right, we move on to country music. Emmylou Harris, one of the great voices of country music. I adore country music. I remember first discovering it through Elvis Costello's brilliant Almost Blue album. He put on the front, "If you're small-minded, don't listen." I love it. I love Emmylou. One of these days, one of the most wistful, thought-provoking songs. Great lyric, great song.
I won't let you know
Emmylou Harris singing One of These Days. So, Ben Elton, you ran the two careers, performing and writing, in tandem through the 80s, co-writing Blackadder with Richard Curtis, which also, like the young ones, was eventually to win a BAFTA, doing the stand-up stuff on Channel 4, Saturday and Friday Live. It was about then, wasn't it, that the criticism began? That at first you were the smug git in the shiny suit, which was in fact your phrase, I think. I bet you regret ever saying that.
Well, what I said was, a lot of people see me as a smug git in a shiny suit. I never considered myself smug. I think it's a
But you got rid of the shiny suits.
I certainly got rid of the shiny suits.
But the press became very poisonous. They cottoned onto that and they developed it. I mean, it became extremely nasty. You became, let me quote some adjective, obnoxious and foul-mouthed smart-ass and so all that. What brought all that on, in your view? Why you? You got it in the neck in a way that other comedians didn't.
It's very nice of you to say so, because I did used to think, why me? I do think that the efforts to get at me were very personal. Oh, he's a hypocrite. He says he's all politics, but then look at, well, he must be a billionaire by now. He's been on the telly and all that. Because the attacks were always the things that I feel I loathe most. Hypocrisy, smugness, pomposity, being opinionated. I may appear a bit, all comedians are opinionated, because an act has to have some vigour, it has to have some passion. But privately, I love to listen, I love to discuss. I believe democracy in one's life and in one's country is the most important way to run.
So you're a victim of your own style, were you? That your style is slightly know-all because you don't stop and it keeps rattling out, as we say.
The fear of the gong, the comedy store gong, has hung over me, so it'll cast a very long shadow, the gong.
But the gong gongs you off when you're too awful and you've got to go.
Exactly. I was never gonged, but one of the reasons I was never gonged was I talked so fast it was impossible to get even one beat of a gong in. And I do believe that my early days as a comic informed my style and I think influenced me.
But obviously, to an extent, it was a right-wing press having a go at you because you were knocking Mrs. Thatcher through the 80s. I mean, the first question is, would you be as irritated by and as critical of a Labour government?
The 1945 to 51 Labour government? No. I think it's the finest administration that Britain ever produced, and the NHS is the crowning glory of our nation.
But what they're saying about you is you're a natural Labour supporter and therefore enjoyed knocking Thatcher, as you call
No,
it.
Not at all. I'm not a natural anything supporter. I'm not a party political comedian. My support, for what it's worth, is not for the Labour Party per se. It's for policies of which I approve, and there have been some things that Conservatives have done that I've approved of. What I was doing in the 80s on Saturday Live and Friday Live as a live comedian was doing the job that a live comedian, particularly a young one on Channel 4, damn well ought to do, which is looking at the powers that be and having a go. Having a go, though, based on principle. I believe satire without principle is a blunt sword indeed. If you just take the mick out of someone's long upper lip or glasses or whatever, or you say, well, I've had a go at the Tories, I'd better have a go at Labour, that's pointless. You must have
passion
in your work.
You don't say anything that you don't believe?
Never.
Record number 5.
My next record is from Bob Dylan. I could have chosen almost anything that Bob Dylan ever wrote or performed. I've chosen a track from Blood on the Tracks, I think his greatest album, although, my Lord, there's a number to choose from. That wonderful, evocative song, which I remember listening to lonely in my caravan all those years ago as a indulgently sad 16-year-old, Simple Twist of Fate.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark. She looked at him and he felt a spark tingle to his bones. 'Twas then he felt alone and wished that he'd gone straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate. They walked along by the old canal, a little confused, I remember well, and stopped into a strange hotel with a neon burning bright. He felt the heat of the night hit him like a freight train moving with a simple twist of fate.
Bob Bob Dylan and Simple Twist of Fate from his album Blood on the Tracks. Let's cut to your writing then, Ben. Four novels since 1989. The first three, although containing plenty of those one-liners, had serious environmental themes. You're, among everything else, an eco-freak as well.
An eco-freak. Is it freaky to worry about pollution? I don't know. I'm very environmentally concerned. I'm sure you are. I don't think anybody who has eyes to see and a mind to think or whatever would not be concerned about the fact that we are clearly dirtying up the planet at a considerable rate.
So do you feel equally passionate about violence on the screen, which of course is the theme of your fourth novel, Popcorn?
I feel passionate about responsibility. I must say very quickly that violence on the screen is as broad a church as love on the screen. I value my right as an individual to see challenging and difficult imagery. I want to see a good production of Macbeth. I loved Pulp Fiction. There is violence and there is violence. I believe the problem is that some artists are disingenuously using the freedoms which we treasure to produce salacious and pornographic imagery which they know is appealing simply to the lowest common denominator.
We're talking about Oliver Stone here and Natural Born Killers.
No, I don't think he did it deliberately. I think it's a very poor piece of work and I think he made a big mistake. I actually think it's not as simple as that. Art influences people, but if it does, what are we to do about it? Do we want our movie makers to make films tailored to avoid provoking the unguessable sensibilities of maniacs? Fred West watched Disney videos. Was Shakespeare to not write Hamlet because there were loonies then as there are loonies now? Don't forget that cars kill thousands of people. Every time you get in your car, you potentially become a murderer. But we know that society needs cars, we need transport, and hence we consider it a fair enough risk, just as we consider alcohol a fair enough risk. What we need, to put it glibly, is we need careful drivers, we need careful artists. When artists produce a piece of work, they must remember they're part of a community,
and
they should enrich that community.
But why did you write the book? I mean, we should explain for people who don't know about it that you know, it's very funny, there's a lot of black humour in it. It's about a couple of serial killers who arrive at the Hollywood home of a director of a film, a kind of Oliver Stone figure, forgive me for repeating, but it's that kind of guy, isn't it? And they say that his film inspired them to kill, and they seek to blame him. Now, perhaps you wrote it then not because you feel that strongly about screen violence, but because copycat killers as victims is a natty idea. It was good dramatic irony.
Oh, absolutely. The thing that inspired me was to make the dark comedy and the intense drama of the fact that we now have a society which is constantly seeking someone to blame. Every disaster. So who is to blame? Were the social workers to blame? Was counselling offered afterwards? We're always looking for a quick fix, a soundbite fix. We need to look within ourselves. And when the NBK, which is the cool way of saying natural born killers, debate started, I was fascinated to see eminent journalists, writers I respect, confidently making the connection between fictitious violence and real violence. And I thought, well, if they can make that connection, so can killers, and now they have a plea in mitigation. To me, that says something about our culture, our concept of justice, of personal responsibility, and it brought me to think about the images of violence in film. But these are vast, vast issues. And never forget, Sue, that if Oliver Stone is successfully sued by the victim of violence, which is what's happening in America, I believe we can't have films anymore. Because we don't know what's going to provoke someone.
More music.
Please, yes. Well, I'm going to go abroad here. I'm going to go to two phenomenal vocalists, Vicar and Linda Bull. They're Australians of Maori extraction, and they're singing a song by the brilliant Australian songwriter Paul Kelly. This is just a great pop song. It's House of Love by Vicar and Linda Bull.
We've got to get out somehow. If we ever needed help from above, I know that we need it now. You and I like firewood, and the smoke in this neighbor's food. Ah, something's burning in the house of love. We can pray. Come to
House of Love by Vicar and Linda Bull. You sound like a workaholic, Ben. We haven't even mentioned your stage plays and The Thin Blue Line, which Rowan Atkinson has been doing on BBC One, written by you, and your national stand-up tour this winter. Does it all flow very easily still? Do you sit down and work to order for set hours every day?
Set-ish hours. I'm working very hard at the moment with Thin Blue Line and seeing perhaps less of my wife than I'd like to. But when I'm writing, of course, we have our evenings. I don't work evenings when I'm writing.
Thought you went down the pub then.
I like the pub. I like the pub slightly less. Well, we do occasionally. We go out to meal with friends or whatever. I was a big pub man in my 20s. I'm less of a pub man now.
But when you get down the pub, you're a born worrier, I gather. You worry that you haven't turned the lights off back at the house or the gas is still on the hob.
I've got better. I wrote a routine once many years ago called Captain Paranoia, and it was self-therapy on stage because I did get into terrible habits about checking plugs twice and worrying that the gas was running or whatever. But what was delightful was I discovered when I exploited that for those fears in a stage routine that the audience understood. You know, you hear the creak in the middle of the night and it sounds exactly like the stealthy footfall of a mad axeman. So you pull your duvet up because, let's face it, I mean, duvets are a perfect defence for mad axe.
But would there be any bliss for you in solitary confinement on a desert island? Would you like it at all?
I'm very good on my own. I like, I'm perfectly happy with my own company, but no, I only like my own company because I love my life. I'm very fortunate in my friends, in my wife, in my family, and so without that, I think I would be bereft.
Record number 7.
Right, we're going to stay in Australia. The brilliant Australian band Midnight Oil. Huge international reputation. Great rock and roll, committed rock and roll, also marvellous ballads. But we've had a lot of ballads, and I love to rock too. So we're going to take the opening track from the phenomenal Diesel and Dust album by Midnight Oil, and it's Beds Are Burning.
Out where the river broke, the bloodwood and the desert oak, holding wrecks and boiling diesel. Demon bodies by the breeze.
The time has come to say best bet, to pay the rent, to pay our share. The time has come, a fact to fact, it belongs to them.
Beds Are Burning by Midnight Oil. The generally ecstatic reviews for Popcorn, Ben, included one which said, Mr. Elton has found a trade which we must hope will occupy him for the second half of his career. It's a bit of a backhander, but I think it was meant well. Do you think, like the lecturer who told you to give up the ruthless pursuit of the one-liner, he may have a point? That writing is actually, as you said, your first love is where you should go back to, what you should settle for.
I've never done anything else but write. My stand-up comedy has become the highest profile thing I do because, of course, it's me personally live. But that is simply an expression of my writing. I don't consider it any more or less important than writing a novel or writing a sitcom.
But could you manage without appearing?
Oh, definitely. Hmm. But to me, my stand-up work is one equal part of novels, plays, sitcoms. I'm a comedy writer.
Yeah, but
writer.
I wondered, because as we discussed, you have still actually, other than Popcorn, really a fairly poisonous breath. I wonder if you might be a happier chappy if you were behind the scenes a bit more.
Whether you
secretly like it a bit.
Oh, I do like it because I think stand-up comedy is a beautiful medium for delivering comedic ideas. It's as good as sitcom or as good as novels. It keeps you connected with the audience. it means the ideas have to be terribly tightly honed. It's a good discipline to have to write a stand-up routine, because you can waffle a bit on a page and maybe the reader will forgive you. You can't waffle on stage. The death lasts forever.
Last record.
Well, in no great significant order or anything, but we come to Jennifer Warne's version of Leonard Cohen's Ain't No Cure for Love from the famous Blue Raincoat album. I love a sad love song, and I think this has got to be one of the best.
I've loved you for a long, long time. I know this love is real. Don't matter how it all went wrong. That don't change we are. I don't believe the time can heal this wound I'm speaking of. Ah, there ain't no cure. Ain't no cure, there ain't no cure for love. I'm making for you, baby. I can't pretend I'm not. I'd love to see you naked in your body and your thoughts.
Jennifer Warne's An Ain't No Cure for Love from famous Blue Raincoat. So if you could only take one of those records, Ben, which one is it?
I would have to take the Beatles, because the memories, the soundtrack to one's life, you know, all the records and 100 others. The pain of making this selection has been beyond. I feel personally I've insulted so many great artists because I didn't have a chance to acknowledge them. But I believe the Beatles are the greatest.
What about your book?
Well, a decision of extraordinary pain, but in the long run there could only be one choice, and that would be my wedding album, the photos.
Oh, really?
Of my wedding day, which I was certainly the happiest day of my life, and we had one hell of a party, and I think I could sustain myself for quite a long time on the desert island remembering that day, and so that's my choice of books.
What about your luxury?
Well, I don't know how you're going to feel about this. having failed to choose a book that I can read, I've decided to ask if I can take the British Museum with me.
Which bit of it?
Well, I'd like to take it all. I don't suppose you'll let me take the reading room, because that's all the books in the world. And that's what I'd really like to take, because I do love to read. And the idea of only having one book to read in the rest of one's life, I think, is almost to make life not worth living. I recognise you won't let me take a library. That's absurd. But I'd like to take the rest of it. I'd like to take world history. I'd like to take all the things I've never had a chance to study, all the artifacts I've never looked at, all... I love history above all subjects. History is—it's in my family, as we mentioned before. And I love to read a history book. If I can't take a book, I'll take history. I'll have the British Museum if you'll let me.
Ben Elton, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
It's been a very great pleasure.